Hello, world travelers and diners. Hello, Peter. And I want to apologize. I forgot, and you forgot, we both forgot, to wish ourselves happy 35th wedding anniversary last week.
You're the one who's supposed to remember these things. I can't remember what day of the week it is.
Well, this is true. But it was for the 35 glorious years.
Oh, 35. Oh, we're letting that out. We're letting the cat out of the bag, huh? and the location was City Hall in Philadelphia, right under Benjamin Franklin. And for those of you who think it's so romantic of us to get married on the 22nd of June, the inside scoop is it was the first available Friday when we could get a judge, and we only realized afterwards that it was Midsummer's Day, which of course comes after Midsummer Night's Eve, about which Shakespeare wrote a wonderful play. And you see, we're literary stuff today. We just got everything.
Maybe we ought to suggest that or tell people that they're listening to On the Menu.
Oh, there you go.
With Ann and Peter Haig. Yeah, yes.
This is not stories of our life in Philadelphia or anything like that.
No.
And we have you can call it either a miscellany or a grab bag today on today's program, because we've got a series of interesting characters.
Yeah. The first one that's going to come up is Bill Curtis, who is such a colorful personality, but he'll tell he'll explain all the various things that he does, including this wonderful grass fed beef.
And then just to keep you listening to the program, the next segment is called God in a Cup.
Yeah.
So you'll have to wait and find out what that is. then we have TCHO, which is a fascinating way to road test new chocolate. And then finally, we're finishing up with one of America's most celebrated chefs, who just happens to have recently written an authoritative cookbook. So
we have a full house.
It's Ralph Brennan. I always get the Brennans mixed up. Yeah. So Ralph Brennan's come up in the last segment of the program. But let's get the show underway with Bill Curtis from Tallgrass something in Kansas.
Bill Curtis, you are an amazing person. I don't know of any one person who can do so many things and so many diverse things, even hopping cities and states. What is this all about? You have a TV production company. You raise cows. Tell us a little bit about how you ended up where you are.
Well, I'm from Kansas, and I came to Chicago 40 years ago, basically on a broadcast career. Worked for CBS for 30 years. Did a lot of traveling there. Wanted to do documentaries, so upon retirement after 30 years, in 1996, I started my own production company and did documentaries, and have done, I think, narrated 1,000 for A&E, from investigative reports and cold case files and American Justice. And then along the way, I sort of became a convert to the environmental causes, global warming. I was doing those stories 15 years ago when nobody was listening. So today I found or discovered this special, if you will, just way of raising cattle, so they became a health food instead of a danger. Red meat, the danger. And that is simply putting them back on grass. And they create, we've created a line of grass-fed beef.
But now, they're genetically sound. I mean, they have good genetics, too.
Yes, we have discovered or found genetics from this special line of line bred Angus and Red Devon, primarily from Montana ranches, that go back to the Mayflower. And they originally fattened on grass, and we're not crossbred. You know, it wasn't. We've hybridized so many things in our food supply that we've lost taste and exchanged that for shelf life. So this is sort of the same process with cattle. Corn-fed, the big old juicy corn-fed marbled steaks, in my mind, really don't have much taste. You're tasting fat. So if you go back to grass-fed and a true, good grass-fed genetics, you're going to taste the original taste of a steak.
And we can attest that yours is very, very tasty.
Well, good. Thank you.
Now, Peter is motioning. Well, he has a question.
Interestingly, I'm wondering, Bill, have you actually eaten Red Devon beef from Devon?
No, I can't say that I have.
But the interesting thing is that the beef production has taken an uptick in that part of the country, which was not really a cattle raising country, because people found out the quality of the beef, the flavor, which you discovered yourself. They did that in Devon. In fact, a couple of the very best restaurants in the southwest of England, that's the beef that they serve, and it was on the hoof in a field almost next door.
Wow, all this time.
And this kind of thing is happening in different parts of England as well. There are different breeds depending on whether you are. And the Angus, I guess, originally came from Scotland.
Right.
Yes.
There are Welsh blacks. We were in the Lake District, and a chef there was serving Mr. Satterthwaite's beef without even specifying what breed it was.
Aberdeen Angus.
But the breed that really got it all going in the U.S. was the Hereford, right?
Yes, it was.
They
started crossbreeding for other traits. The Angus is more tolerant to heat and extremes of cold, better muscularity, mothering qualities. So they started crossing with the Hereford, and they called them Baldies now, with a white face and a black hide, and that's the preferred breed.
But you're saying red Devons are the ones I want. For the kind
yes,
of result I'm trying to get.
Now, well, me too.
Now let's talk. Well, you said that you had discovered that this is beef that really has a wonderful taste and does well being fattened on grass. Interestingly enough, Argentina, I guess, which at one time was the world's largest beef supplier, all the beef from there is grass fed, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. Although there are a few feedlots that are now trying to serve what they think are the taste needs of the United States.
Oh, no, that's
okay.
A shame.
Yeah,
and I say, don't ruin.
Please,
you know, what
about
you
the
have.
Pompous? Yes.
Now let's dive into this wonderful book a little bit, because you've got some very interesting little-known facts in there about the fat content and the content of various other things which are either health unbeneficial in corn-raised beef, but let's not dwell on that, because we've slammed that already quite enough. But perhaps you can talk just briefly about some of the healthful qualities that grass-fed beef just happens to have.
Yes.
Well, let's go to the title of the book, The Prairie Table Cookbook, and the subhead is The Revolution Toward Healthy Beef from the Trail to Gourmet Kitchens.
It's a long trail, isn't it?
It is.
We've learned a lot about fat, and we've all associated fat with obesity and something bad. And in fact, over the last 60 years, we have created a fat that is bad for us because it's mostly saturated fat, which causes the clogged arteries and the health problems. But essential fatty acids, which were only discovered back around 1972, contain omega-3s, omega-6s, really good nutrients that we, frankly, can't do without in the proper balance. And so those essential fatty acids come primarily in non-saturated fat. Now, non-saturated fat is the kind that comes in grass-fed animals, naturally. Saturated fat is associated with corn fat, and while we won't dwell on it, that corn feeding changes the animal, because it changes the bacteria in the stomach that is required to break down the food.
Which is why they give them all these antibiotics and this and that and the other, because they were never meant to chew corn.
Nope.
Well, now, would it be fair to say, Bill, that, you said just a little bit ago, you sort of implied that you discovered grass-fed beef, when in fact, if I'm reading your book correctly, it's really a rediscovery, because the original Americans who farmed the plains didn't know anything about anything except grass-fed beasts.
Yes.
And you write a lot about that in your book.
I do. That's a personal discovery. And so I stepped away from the commodity cattle-raising market. Mm-hmm. The original, Indians ate grass-fed animals, just like we did 150,000 years ago, or millions. Because they ate buffalo. The bison grazed the plains and ate only grass. Very, very, very similar to grass-fed cattle. Then along came the army, and they were the biggest contractor for beef, and really kind of that's the reason it built, you know, our frontier expansion effort. And then you had the homesteader. All of it was grass up until about 60 years ago. There were occasional corn feeding. But 60 years ago, the corn feeding model really took off because we had an abundance of corn. We got all the corn in the world, and hybrid nitrogen fertilizer, really. Remember the big mountains of corn stacked outside the silo because they didn't have room for it all?
You know, now they're making ethanol and creating world food shortages.
Well, that's right. And the suggestion by Benny is that, well, let's go back to grass-fed cattle, because you've taken the corn away or made it so expensive, we can't make any money anymore in the feedlots.
Now, isn't there another interesting element in this as well, called greed, which is a particularly human thing to do, in that the people who started the feedlot business discovered that you could make the animals a whole lot fatter, a whole lot faster, and as a result, you got more pounds of meat.
Yeah,
all of which sold at the same price.
I can just hear those early conversations.
So,
you know, you mean that simply by feeding corn, we can create it faster and get more money out, and it tastes good too. Well, let's call it marbling. It's a marriage made in heaven,
isn't it? Isn't it just one? This starts out as sort of like almost an anthropology textbook. There's a little bit of animal biology in there.
It's not dry, it's very colorful.
But you go go beyond these fascinating stories, including some stories of beef in the Civil War in Kansas and other parts of the nation, and you decided to make a cookbook. Now, why did you do that?
Well, I wanted to tell the story of our beef company, and it's my, quote, personal discovery, tall grass beef, and this was a good way to do it. You know, that beef on the trail was probably pretty tough when you come down to it. They would slaughter and eat almost the same day when you have to feed all those guys. Now, as you look at some of those, we researched in the small papers and the diaries of the trail drivers, and found their cookies, you know, chuck wagon recipes. And they had a lot of lard they used. It's flour and salt and sugar. That's about all they had as a foreign ingredient. So you were eating the real thing. But beef needs to be aged a bit, at least 21 days, to give it a tenderness. And that's what we do today. Some chefs like to go 28 days. So we've improved on it.
What style of aging do you use?
You know, we use wet aging. And
okay.
We just let it age within the cryovac. We find we already have taste. So we don't need to age for taste.
I see.
And we find it dries out our product too much.
Okay, so when you're aging it, you're simply allowing the enzymes to break down the meat so that it's easier to digest.
You've got it.
Okay,
that's
so
it.
From whence came the idea that you would introduce your beef through recipes from celebrity chefs?
Celebrity chefs is part of our marketing strategy, and they are the ones who are really carrying this revolution. They're pioneering not only good tasting recipes, but also this notion of let's return to something natural. Why? Because they know the truth. They know that our food is overprocessed, oversalted, oversugared, and that we're hurting people. And they want to go back to the real thing. It's the problem is finding the real thing. And so they've gone local with as many sources as they can, even out of backyard victory gardens, if you will. Yeah, the organics.
Yeah, see, that's the balance that, as we were talking before coming on air, I was telling you that I love the grass-fed beef. And I really would like to pursue the local approach to it, the locavore approach. So, yours, though, was for a national market. So it's a matter of how do you balance that with the travel carbon footprint?
Well, it's more difficult than it has been in the past, of course, because fuel is going up. And although we could reinstitute the trail drives of old, but... short of that, there's only one way to get them from one place to another, and that's by truck.
Yeah, it's not.
We've kind of evolved away from the rail, and there are too many regulations.
Yeah.
You have to stop the train and let them off for humane treatment and things
Well,
like
you know,
that.
There are so many little interesting points here. I'm looking at a picture of Arbuckles. One of our best friends is the Arbuckle, is from the Arbuckle family.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and a couple of years ago, they finally revived that brand. Then you have when you talk about health, you have a recipe here from probably my most favorite chef, Michel Nichon, who would not put his name to anything that wasn't healthful. He's a doll. And what was, and I love your, the names of the recipes. I mean, you have Son of a Bitch Stew.
That's right, it is the internet.
Yeah, it is. Oh, and there were some really funny ones. Old recipes. Oh, here's Hell of a Chili. Chuck Wagon Scrapple. Splatter Dabs. Now, I never even heard of a splatter.
Well, the splatter dabs are quite, quite famous. One, it was a Civil War era and easy to make. Uh-huh. But then it goes back to, you know, you're looking for sustenance rather than that sweet-tasting, unusual meal. Mm-hmm.
So it's like a hot cake?
Yes, and you kind of create it with all the fixings that you have left over from other meals.
Wonderful. Oh, I think people will find this delightful. The book is on our website, so anybody who wants to get a copy of it, and I think you should, should go to the OTM bookshelf and search it and order it directly from there. You also can go to, if you want to order the beef, you can go to your website, which is tallgrassbeef.com, just as it sounds. And I just think, you have me hooked on this beef, Bill, so I don't know what I'm going to do next.
Well, I'm delighted to a fan.
And just to give listeners a first-hand report from the person who cooked all three of them, and then we ate everything you sent in one sitting.
Oh, great.
I thought that the ribeye was the best.
Did you? That's my favorite, too.
Yeah.
But are the other people, so many people like sirloin, and, of course, the tender, most tender, is the filet. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you can't just have it from any animal called grass-fed. They have to have those genetics.
Right.
Well, see, that's what I was telling you. I run into the problems finding those genetics in local grass-fed beef.
So what can be wrong, listeners, with a product which is good for you, it tastes good, and you can find great ways to cook it? And
the
answer is Bill Curtis and Tallgrass Beef. Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. Quite a pleasure.
Thanks, Bill.
I'm going to go try that stew.
There you go.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're going to remind you once again that our email is onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. And we love to hear from you.
We absolutely do. And now moving right along.
Now you're going to have to reveal the mystery. What is God in a cup?
The mystery of God in a cup. Yeah. Well, it's an interesting story that, that Ann talks about in detail during the interview anyway, but the God we're referring to is the superior quality of a particular kind of coffee that the author of a book recently published just happened to pick up on.
Michael Weissman, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you.
I must say that when I got this book called God in a Cup, my first thing was, oh no, here I go again. Why am I so punished? I just had to read the history of bacon. But then I got into this book, and it's a good read.
Well, hold on a second. We better get this right. God in a Cup sounds like it might be something that Mike Huckabee would be interested in. and it's really not about religion at all, except to the extent of the religious fervor in coffee. So
the subtitle is The Obsessive Quest for the Perfect Coffee, and that's what it's about. And this is a great book, Michael.
Well, that is music to the writer's ears. Thank you.
Well,
you make it
into a great adventure story.
Well, it was an adventure.
It was certainly an adventure.
Where do we start with this? I mean, I didn't know there was three waves, and we were in the third wave of coffee, and I didn't know that these coffee guys were, you know, young entrepreneurs and with a whole different culture, and I've never been half the places you've been. What do you want to talk about?
Well, you know, I guess where I would start to make this story comprehensible is with Starbucks, because that's where I started. As a food reporter, I was doing a lot of freelance stories for the Washington Post and the New York Times, and I started to get little emanations and little comments about coffee, and I got this hunch that there was what I called the upscaling of office coffee among the Starbucks generation, that young people who never knew the world before, or the work world before Starbucks, when they went into the office in the morning, they wanted better coffee than that usual overboiled, miserable stuff. And that's where the story began for me, because I started pursuing office coffee, and I found out that my hunch was right. And in my hometown of Washington, D.C., young people in the workforce were kind of demanding of their bosses better coffee, or else in workplaces where the boss doesn't offer the coffee, they were starting clubs, they were making runs to Starbucks, and in some cases, I didn't know this, but they were getting very involved in the world of boutique coffee, which I always think of as beginning where Starbucks left off, that Starbucks was the first intro to high quality beans for many, 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 many Americans. But then a younger generation of coffee fans and fanatics were saying, there's better than that. And a new generation of roasters, of coffee roasters in some American cities, not all, were going to Latin America and Africa and Asia and buying coffees, and they comprise what coffee people in the industry, people in the specialty coffee industry, which is the high end of the coffee industry, call the third wave.
Right.
Yeah, I love your first wave, which is about dreadful coffee and even more dreadful soluble coffee, as you describe it.
Yes.
Right. Now you enjoyed the people as much as you enjoyed the places and the coffee, as I gather from your book.
I have to confess, that's the kind of foodie I am. I'm a people-loving foodie, and I found these young people in this business completely fascinating and sort of energizing. And I had, because I'm kind of a generalist reporter, in addition to writing about food, I'd been writing about entrepreneurs and small business for quite some time, and I was completely taken by these, what I call the coffee guys, although I've been castigated because some of them are definitely girls, but
women. Oh, there are women in this.
But I think of the term coffee guy as a kind of all-purpose term, because I use it because they're informal. This new generation of coffee entrepreneurs, they're informal, they're young, they're a little bit of the smarty pants, and they're a lot of fun. And I think of guys as a word that sort of encompasses those kind of people, or that kind of people. And I had never met entrepreneurs quite like them, because they had the complete obsessive commitment to what they were doing of, say, high-tech entrepreneurs, but they had a tremendous amount of altruism. They had gone to coffee farms in all over the world, and they had this almost mystical, romantic, but very grounded commitment to making life better for coffee farmers.
And actually, your title comes from a description of Esmeralda Special, right?
Yes, one of these very wonderful coffees. Actually, this is a coffee of tremendous interest. It's called Esmeralda Special. It grows on a small farm in Panama. And the growers are a lovely family by the name of Peterson, who were originally North Americans and settled in Panama in the 1970s. And this coffee never had appeared on any market anywhere in the world until 2004. And when it made its appearance at an early coffee competition, a very well-known guy in the coffee business, when he tasted it, he said, I think his absolute quote was, "Although I am not a religious man, when I tasted this coffee, I saw the face of God
in the cup. And that's how it's called, God in a cup.
Now, this is a coffee that I think I drank this coffee in a coffee tasting with Pete's, because they, Pete, that's P-E-E-T-S, because I think they bought some of the early harvest. The person that I talked to there said these were rather unusual trees. They were not the common or garden Panamanian coffee trees. Somehow or other, they had a root that went further back than that.
That's exactly correct. And what people don't realize is that all the coffee that grows in our hemisphere, in the Western Hemisphere, is the genetic offspring of two cultivars that were basically stolen from Africa 500 years ago and got to Latin America by the usual voyagers and adventurers coming this way. And this coffee doesn't come from these traditional Latin American cultivars. It's neither a hybrid of them, nor is it the original itself. And when people first tasted this coffee, they were sort of so struck and so bemused, and the price that it auctioned off for was so high, there was a tremendous amount of curiosity. And it was traced back first to a research lab in Costa Rica, and then after that, where it had been growing for 40 or 50 years, and from Costa Rica it had been sent to Panama 50 years ago when Panamanian farmers were looking for a disease-resistant tree. But its true origin went back to Ethiopia in 1931, and a British consul of sort of an adventurous stripe had gone into the forest and picked up coffee beans off the forest floor, and had sent them to different research labs. And this Ethiopian origin of this coffee, which is called Esmeralda, although its cultivar name is Geisha, opens up a tremendously fascinating aspect of coffee as a gourmet crop.
Does it taste really that fabulous?
Well, now that's a really interesting point, because the question is, does it taste that fabulous to a normal coffee drinker, or does it taste that fabulous to a coffee taster? And we can say, if you or I went to our first wine tasting and someone gave us, you know, a $200 or $300 or $400 bottle of Burgundy, would we love it? And when I tasted this Esmeralda, I thought it was a wonderful, it's kind of a light, fruity, pure, comfortable, not fragrant, delicious coffee. Would I have paid $130 a pound wholesale for this coffee? Probably not. But I'm not a trained coffee taster. I'm a journalist. The more I've tasted this coffee, the more I've come to love it, because in the course of doing this story, my own palate has been educated.
Yeah, that always happens. And then how do you support this habit?
we call that vintage creep.
I can understand that completely. Now, so we've done three waves. Now, what's next? Is there a fourth wave?
Oh, no, because, perhaps, but I think that as far as the third wave is concerned, it hasn't. Look, you're a lovely, wise, and educated foodies in Pittsburgh, and has a local roaster come to your area yet who is a third wave guy or gal who is going to origin or going to Africa or Latin America buying these great coffees and roasting them up and selling them fresh? It sounds like it hasn't. So I think the third wave, which is these young people opening up the coffee business beyond Starbucks, I don't think it's only happening in the two coasts and in Chicago, a little bit in Kansas City, and quite a number of cities in Canada. But we have so far to go. You know, having fallen in love with this coffee and also having visited the farms and understanding what this market in more expensive so-called specialty coffees can mean for the farmers, I want to see this come, you know,
proliferate.
I want to see food lovers in every American city have access to locally roasted, delicious coffee.
Yeah, I mean, we have local roasters, but not of the ilk that goes for 200.
No, there's some fair trade work going on, but I think there's nobody operating at this at the $135 a pound wholesale kind of level. That's for sure.
But you don't need. You know, it's funny. Since I got into this, I order coffee from the three companies that I followed in this book. I followed buyers from these three companies around the world, and I order my coffee from these coffee roasters. And I don't. What I pay a pound is kind of what you'd pay for a good bottle of wine. And I my coffee costs, I'd say, between $12, $15, $16 a pound. And for that pound of wonderful hand roasted coffee, I get 30 to 40 cups of coffee. Now you pay $15 for a bottle of wine, you know, one meal or two for two people, that's it. So I think that we don't have to, the $130 a pound is the far, far reaches of this market. There are wonderful, wonderful coffees from, the ones I'm drinking this right now are from Rwanda. They're from Peru. And I just ordered a coffee from Papua New Guinea.
Oh, yeah. We lived in Australia. I'm sorry we didn't get to Papua New Guinea.
Well, listeners, it's a wonderful story. It's called God in a Cup. It will change your mind about what you should think about drinking at breakfast time.
Is it on our website already?
I can't remember, but if not, it will be on there very soon. And Michael, I want to thank you for joining the program to tell us a little bit about this great adventure, and people should just read it for themselves and explore the things that we've talked about here. So thank you so much for joining us. Yeah.
And let us know what your next book is, Michael.
Thank you. I would love to. The book is out as of the beginning of May. It has been published, and I thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. Take care.
Well, I just was totally surprised by it and totally pleased, and it's wonderful. Congratulations on a fabulous book.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay, Michael.
Bye for now.
Let us know what you're doing.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, she's certainly a fascinating author.
I didn't note the fact that her name is Michael. I have a cousin, Michael. We have some gender confusion here, but not to worry.
Yeah. So, they're very complicated. But anyhow, so we now...
We're going to take a pause for the cause.
Yes.
And we'll talk to you on the other side.
You're putting words in my mouth.
I try hard not to do that, but words in Anne's mouth, it's time to
take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, moving right along. In fact, we're moving from coffee beans to cacao beans, as in chocolate. And I'm not sure if this is really a masterful marketing program or research and development, but listen to our interview with Choate. Well, On the Menu, as you know, loves chocolate, and we've interviewed so many chocolateers and sampled so many chocolates, and of course we're just thrilled to have a new one to play with, Cho Chocolates. I have Timothy Childs on the phone. Hi, Timothy.
Hey, good afternoon.
Yes, and one of the things about, well, there are many things about it. First of all, the background of your chocolate. The thing that caught my attention right away, besides the wonderful flavor, was the whole process of this beta adventure. Tell us first how you ended up, you being a, what kind of a technician? Hello?
I was labeled as a technologist.
A space shuttle technologist.
Yeah, I basically, one of my previous companies, I built real-time machine vision tracking systems for the the orbiter program, or commonly known as the space shuttle.
So, but a while ago, you already left that kind of a job and moved into Cabaret Chocolates.
Correct. I'm actually a partner that I met in the computer graphic business, where my background is in, luckily drug me into the worlds of chocolate. I was a confectioner before at Cabaret. We made a really great, incredibly strong and delicious confection, kind of a special ganache, which really was incredible. And that's where I learned a lot about how to work with chocolate. And from there, I learned how kind of difficult and challenging chocolate making is about. And I kind of took on that challenge, rightfully so, and really embraced it and took it on. And hence, a couple years later, started CHO.
Technology meets chocolate. Go and explain.
It's a nickname. We wanted to have a nice, short, very pronounceable name, and that's kind of what we're really about at CHO. Is we're Silicon Valley, which is a lot of technological innovations come from, meets the San Francisco food culture, kind of the home for the slow food movement. You kind of combine those two together, and that's kind of who we kind of are. We're technology meets chocolate, hence the truncated name CHO.
And you're co-founder, the co-founder of Wired Magazine, huh?
Yeah, my one of my primary investors, Louis Rossetto, who's been a friend for many years, he was one of my main investors coming in, and he liked it so much, he became the CEO of the company. He and his partner, Jane Metcalf, who's also an investor, they co-founded Wired.
Now, you make all your bars from scratch, and you source your top-quality beans in Africa and South America. In fact, you said you were going to be off to Costa Rica today or tomorrow.
Yeah, so what we've done at CHO is I kind of, I like to solve really challenging problems, and one of the big problems I was looking at is the whole kind of supply chain, how chocolate's actually made and delivered, and looked at all the points along the way, and looked what's the areas that can benefit from the most innovation, and the most important part of that kind of loop, what I call it, because the two ends are really connected, is what's the experience like for the end consumer, right? So you go to a premium grocery store, and you see waves and waves and waves of chocolate, but how do you make a buying decision? So what I decided to do is kind of simplify that, and I came up with a flavor taxonomy. In essence, it's a simplified model of the chocolate universe, and instead of positioning chocolate as by region, because you can get like four or five flavors from region, so that's not a really good indicator, I decided to do it by flavors. Not adding chocolate, and not adding flavors to the chocolate, but identifying six main kind of inherent flavors in chocolate, like, for example, chocolatey or fruity or nutty or floral and so on. So we source the beans, getting to kind of where you started with the question is, I've specifically sourced beans that have these inherent qualities to them. For example, our first one that you've probably tasted by now is the chocolatey one. That comes from Ghana. That was lots of love got put into that, and that was grown and roasted in Ghana. And the next thing I'm working on right now is fruity, which is from Peru. And I'm actually going down to Costa Rica Monday to go roast another 16 tons of beans from there. So what we do is we pair the chocolates from the region based upon the flavor. So I kind of have this blueprint I set up, and then we trounce around the world finding the right beans. And, for example, like I've been through 33 different bean samples just to find what I like for the fruity. And once we've got that, I order 16 tons and I go roast those up and ship it up here to finish processing up here at our
facility. How fat are you, Timothy?
What's that?
Huh?
Well, I'm sorry, can you hear me?
How fat are you?
Oh, how fat am I? No, I actually lose weight. Actually, that's the whole thing about our chocolate is we designed it to be very satisfying. You don't have to eat a whole lot of it to get a big
is true.
Wallop. And there's the French concept of satiation.
I just took a little bit.
It's really hard
time
for me here. My apologies. I'm so hard. It's so hard to hear in the background.
Uh-huh. Anyhow, explain the chocolate's beta adventure program.
Did you say explain the beta chocolate program, right?
Yes.
Yeah, the CHO beta chocolate program is something that I came up with to kind of get our friends and family in on the process early on, because everybody, as you know, everybody loves chocolate, and when you're making new flavors and stuff, it's really great to get feedback from people as well as kind of get people involved in the process, because they'll it's good to have the love spread all the way around. And so basically I've come up with a similar model, just like what it's like for software, where before you have a final release candidate, you let an inside group of users use your product and get feedback. And so when you ship the final product, you've kind of test driven a little bit. So I've done the same thing with chocolate.
So basically, you sent chocolate out for tasting and encouraged, or people actually could go on your web page and ask for the samples and ask to join this club.
Yeah, the tasting circle, right. And so what happens is, like, I'll make a batch, and then it's got a particular batch number to it, and you go to our website, and you give us your comments based upon that. And so this is how I can test things about, like, this isn't a vanilla, or maybe I'll roast this a little dark and see what the general feedback is.
Now we got beta testing samples, didn't we, Tim? Isn't that what we got?
Yes.
And they were quite delicious, by the way. We don't have any of them left. I mean, they disappeared really fast.
They go quick. If you go to cho.com, you can order some more, but we'll gladly send you some. and you want to hear something amazing? 40, yeah. I think 42 or 46% of the people who actually purchase chocolates from us actually go to the website and give us feedback. Isn't that amazing?
Now, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you. What kind of feedback are you getting? Are these people who know what they're talking about?
Yeah, so it's so surprising because we've got a few people that just will go on, and give us really, really luscious details. It's stuff that I didn't even pick up at some point. But we're starting to find out that there's people that say, oh, I just love it. Generally, I'd say 98% of the feedback is like, great chocolate, love it, chocolatey, and it's all that. And the only negative comments we usually get are because they don't feel like it's perfectly finished. But that's kind of the inherent properties of the beta program, is because, it's not, we're working on flavor, not necessarily finished at this stage. But the feedback I get is really, really detailed at some points, and I really do take some stuff back, like saying, like, hey, how about, it's had this really long-lasting flavor. Be great if, X, Y, Z happened. So sometimes it's inspirational, but it's more like a check to make sure that, that the concepts that I think they're going to fly, I get some real-time feedback from our audiences. It's really great. It's really been really, really
now,
fun to read. I read every
think...
comment, and we try to reply to everybody that sends us a comment.
Oh, do you? Now, where do you think this is all going to go? I mean, the fine chocolate market is getting ever more crowded.
Right. Well, there's definitely, more people getting in the space, and hence why it's really important to have, key differentiations and really kind of have the best, best commitment to ultimately the most amazing beans that you can get, and with love put all the way through it and making the best chocolate out of it. But if you look at the general compound growth interest, there's a compound growth rates of premium chocolate as a whole, and organic and fair trade on chocolate. On top of that, it's still the supply is being outstripped by the demand. So there's still a lot, still plenty of room for the players. But I think what we do is we offer something unique in the sense that we've tried to come up with a really simplified worldview of chocolate flavors to let people kind of discover their own chocolate flavors. This is like choosing wine. I want a dark, or I want a white or red or whatever. The other things that how we differentiate ourselves is we have a thing called ChoSource, where we work deeply with the farmers that we work with, specifically by reinvesting. This is what we plan on doing, is reinvesting the revenues that we create from the sales of the chocolate into, upgrading and improving their infrastructure for making chocolate. The two most important processes for flavor development is fermentation and drying. And so by us doing a little investments, we can increase the quality of their beans, and we get charged more for them. They get more money, and it's just, and our customers get a better product, and all the way down the line. So we're really trying to think the whole process through with just really intent and abandon for how can we improve it along the way.
And can people actually buy some? We've just been talking about the beta program and all the people in that, but you also have commercial products available, correct?
Yeah, right now we're shipping the chocolatey. I'm working on the fruity next, and then I think in early summer is when we're going to have the rest of the product line available on our website. And then we're actually at Pier 17 in San Francisco, if anybody knows San Francisco.
Right
between the Ferry Building, which is kind of the epicenter for slow food, and Fisherman's Wharf, which is kind of just opposite, but it's massively tourist. And we're right smack dab in the middle, and we're going to be launching a store with a cafe-like environment, as well as a tasting room, as well as a complete factory tour. So that's going to come online late summer.
Yeah.
So we'll have our product line available at that time.
Directly next to Rick Uti, no?
Can you say that again, please?
Rick Uti Chocolates?
Rick Uti. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ricuti's got a store, and so does Scharfenberger, down at the Ferry Building.
Yeah.
Ricuti's a confectioner. He takes other people's chocolates and makes stuff with it. And Cho, we're one of the few chocolate makers that actually...
And Scharfenberger's been sold to Hershey.
What's that?
Scharfenberger sold to Hershey.
Yep, and they also bought DeGoba as well.
Oh yeah,
Tell me about Joseph Schmidt if you know that product.
Oh
that
yes.
No, we heard about Scharfenberg. He said he kept on saying no, and they kept on increasing the amount of money. And finally, when he got to $75 million, he said, "You won. You gave me enough gold." Anyway, the company is called
Cho. And the website
it is.
It's TCHO, and it's cho.com.
Great. There we go. And we know you just got back from Germany and only just got a bite to eat before you came to this interview, and you're off to Costa Rica on Monday. So, Tim, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. Happy travels, huh?
Likewise. And it's an honor and privilege to be speaking to you.
Likewise with us.
Well, I hope to see you out in San Francisco.
Following your progress.
Yeah,
you were too.
Yeah, you were both talking at the same time there. But what Tim said is we have to come see him next time we go to San Francisco, which we certainly will. And Anne was saying congratulations and keep up the great work.
Our pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
Ciao,
bye-bye.
Tim. And it's time again to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Once again, a little plug for our email. It's onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. Send suggestions for programs, give comments, whatever. Now we're going to be talking to, the Brennan family is synonymous with beautiful food people. I mean, just there's so many of them. We now have
we got them rather confused.
Well,
we got them mixed up.
Well, yeah, but we interviewed Dickie before when we were at the Charleston Wyden Food Festival, and now we just interviewed Ralph, a cousin, when he had this wonderful book published. So why don't we just listen to what he had to say? We're talking to Ralph Brennan. And from where? I didn't even know. What restaurant are you in right now, Ralph?
Well, actually, I'm not in a restaurant. I'm in my office. But I have three restaurants in New Orleans, Baco, Redfish Grill, and Ralph's on the Park.
Right. And you have what we're going to talk about today, a new cookbook, the New Orleans Seafood Cookbook, which is gorgeous. Ah, I said before we went on air that I'm just so hungry from looking at the photographs. The photographs are just out of this world.
Thank you very much. They're photographs by Carrie McCafferty, who is a recognized photographer here from New Orleans, and she has done a number of books, but never a cookbook. So this is her first effort at the cookbook. But
she's really good at crabs.
Yeah, she's great. You know, one of the things, she doesn't use any artificial light, so it's all natural light, and I think more texture comes through.
Oh,
you get
that
a more
why?
Natural looking photograph. That's what I love about her work.
Oh, it's great. And then you also you were assisted in the actual writing process, putting it together with my friend Gene Borg.
Yes.
Would you say hello to him? He introduced, we had lunch once, and we just sort of fell out of contact. He introduced me to Rio Mar.
Oh, yes.
Which is a lovely restaurant.
Yeah, a lovely restaurant. And I'm just the chef's name.
It's Alfredo or Alberto or something.
If you go to our website, onthemenuradio.com, and go to OTM and Pictures, there's a photograph of me with two chefs there.
Oh, great.
And so
my wife and I were there a couple months ago and had a wonderful dinner.
Oh,
yeah,
it's really actually, it's so funny. The gentleman who waited on us turned out to be the part owner with the chef. so we took a great picture of them all together.
Good.
Well, anyhow,
good.
This is the ultimate resource, this cookbook on Louisiana seafood. Ralph, could you just break down the different sections, because it sort of explains how anybody would use this, not only as a cookbook, but as a reference book.
Right. Well, what we wanted to do is we wanted to make it very simple for the home cook to use. And I've found over the years that sometimes our guests in the restaurants are uncomfortable cooking seafood at home.
Everybody's
so what we
afraid
did in the
it.
Front of the book is we have a section, we call it the Seafood Cook's Guide, and it shows you how to handle seafood finfish, crabs, shrimp, oysters, etc. And it shows you the proper way to like fillet a fish, and then how to store the fish or the crab meat or the shrimp.
And in photographs, how to fillet a fish too.
Exactly. We used one of our chefs there, and Carrie took the photograph. Very detailed photographs. In fact, we tried to be very specific throughout the book, and each of the recipes is very detailed and specific, and we didn't leave any steps out or any ingredients, and we triple-checked the recipes so that they should all work at home.
You know, it's interesting, Ralph. It is a little bit intimidating to cook seafood. This is Peter, who grew up cooking on the outdoor barbecue grill. And the first time that I put a piece of really expensive fish on there, I was petrified because I've got this $20 piece of halibut, and I'm worried that I'm going to just totally destroy it.
Right.
And I think, you know, fish has gotten even more expensive since then. So what you're doing here is really tremendously valuable to make sure that the people are successful and they don't feel like they wasted the money on this super prize ingredient that they spent all this money for.
Right, and you know, we do give you some tips on how to prepare it, and you know, you just, I think over, you need a little bit of experience. So if people are willing to try seafood, particularly fish, for example, and grill it, it's a wonderful, healthy way to eat. And with a little bit of practice, and you watch the timing, I often cook by timing when I'm at home, you can easily cook fish. And, you know, there are a lot of great stores around the country today, you know, that have great seafood sections, and it's easy to find high-quality seafood in most areas of the country.
Yeah, you just have to dig deeper into your pocket than you'd like, I guess, in
well,
some
that's
cases.
True. That's true, but it is good, healthy food for you, seafood is. And, you know, shrimp is another example of an item that's readily available in many parts of the country.
Well, when we were last in New Orleans, we talked to John Besh, and John was saying that the seafood in the Gulf had never been better since Katrina. So if you could say that something like Katrina actually had a good side, it was that it flushed out all the little backwaters that hadn't seen fresh water for a long time, and as a result, the bounty was all back.
That's right. That's right. And you know, when Katrina first hit and passed, and in the early days afterwards, we thought we'd lose our seafood supply for a long time. And the Wildlife and Fisheries Department here that controls all of that for the state issued some very dire warnings. But Mother Nature took over, and within a very short period of time, we had some wonderful seafood back, and it's continued for the last couple of years.
Now you have here shrimp. You have white shrimp, brown shrimp, and rock shrimp. I just read of a new one, Royal Reds. Did you hear that?
No.
It's supposed to be from really way, way deep down in cold waters.
Well, we got some great wild American shrimp from Florida, right? From the Wild Shrimp Association.
Yeah, I guess.
Right.
And
yeah.
that was a terrific product. But one thing that the director of that organization was telling us is that, you know, what's happened is that farmed shrimp from Asia so dominates the market now that it's hard for the good old American shrimp boater to stay in business.
That's right. It's very difficult because their costs are very high here, and to get that good Gulf shrimp is very expensive. We're having the same issue in Louisiana with crawfish. We raise crawfish here domestically. In fact, we're right at the peak of the season right now, and they have a lot of competition from China. And
Of course,
they're able to bring it into the country for a lot less than it costs to produce here. And the crawfishermen here are having a lot of problems.
So you can have Chinese crawfish after you took your heparin injection.
Yeah.
and you won't care whether it's good or bad. Now let's go down this pathway called Creole and Cajun, because you explain in the book that there are similarities and differences, and those similarities and differences, I'm sure, are represented in the recipes in your book.
Yeah, he has, by the way, a glossary. He has a section called Appendices, Tips and Special Instructions, a glossary of Creole and Acadian food terms, then seafood and wine pairings and ingredient sources. So I guess you get some of the spirit of the Creole.
But can you give us a quick explanation of the difference?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. Although, you know, over the years, they have grown closer and closer together. You know, in the past, I think there was a clear difference between Creole and Cajun, where Creole was more city food, more sophisticated food. The food that was cooked in the country in southwest Louisiana was more of the food cooked off the land, more game, heavier flavors, heavier spices in order to mask some of the some of the flavors that were in some of the ingredients that they were cooking there. But as the two have come together and as more chefs have moved into New Orleans, they've gotten closer and closer together. Both, though, have bold, intense flavors. But, you know, you take a gumbo, for example. Many of the gumbos that we serve are rich, hearty gumbos that would come out of southwest Louisiana, as opposed to a lighter bisque, like a crawfish bisque, that would be more of a New Orleans-style dish with a cream base.
So, yeah, one of the I thought a wine pairing nightmare must be this. It looked wonderful, the soup. It was oyster and artichoke bisque.
Yes.
Loaded with cream, of course.
So you got.
You drink with that?
So you got two things that are difficult to pair with wine, and you put them together and just make it even more difficult. I would drink champagne.
But. I mean, I would probably go with a Sauvignon Blanc. Uh-huh.
Okay.
A nice dry Sauvignon Blanc with some good acid in it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the bubbles will be all right too, right?
Yeah. Well, yes, you could do that. I haven't done that in a while.
Bubbles go with everything.
Yes, they do.
The other thing I loved the crab and corn, fresh corn soup with the ingredients all laid out and photographed. Oh, it looks so gorgeous. Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
Continue. No, the crab and corn soup, yep. That's an old dish that's been around for a long time. And it was one, I guess, came back. I remember coming back, the first time I remember seeing it is about 20 years ago at Commander's Palace.
Really?
And Paul Prudhomme might have been the chef at the time there.
There you go. So Paul was at Commander's Palace, and
right.
he went through the family, right?
Yes, he did. He did. He spent most of his time at Commander's, and then he sort of became like a corporate chef over several of the restaurants at the time.
And then there was that wonderful Jamie Shannon who passed away so sadly, huh?
Yes, yes.
Oh, I forgot
about
that.
Wonderful chef.
Yeah, he was a wonderful
chef.
Yeah, he had just won a Beard Award, I think, hadn't he?
I don't remember.
I think he just won Best Chef.
I was shocked.
Maybe he did.
Whatever
Best
region it was, I think
East,
he did.
Maybe.
Yeah, and I got to tell my Commander's Palace story. We were walking the Garden District on Sunday morning, so we showed up for Sunday brunch at the Commander's Palace, and I didn't have a jacket.
Okay.
And I couldn't sit down to lunch until I got a jacket, which was a 44 extra large, and it sat on the back of the chair the whole time.
Yep.
But I was appropriately attired.
Yeah, we had to wait till somebody gave it up.
Yeah. And the jazz players came over to me at first, I guess, because I had the nicest jacket, and said, "What would I like them to play?" And I said, "I want St. James Infirmary," and they said, "That's our favorite."
Yeah, and you know, that was at a time, you know, when we were still trying to maintain that type of dress code, and over the years, that's changed quite a bit. Now.
You can't do it anymore.
Okay, so I can show up now, and I won't have to wait for a jacket.
You will not have to wait for a jacket.
That's wonderful.
Now,
there are a couple of other restaurants that require it in town. I don't think any of ours do now.
Okay,
let's just
lifestyles have changed.
Ralph, let me just run through here. You have sections on different fish: fin fish, crabs, crawfish, shrimp, oysters, alligator, frog's legs, and turtle. I never knew there was a soft-shell turtle, by the way, until I read this book. Is there such a thing?
A soft-shell turtle?
Yeah.
Did we say that in here?
I think so.
I don't think so.
Well, Anne's just reading the titles, I think.
Yeah, but I thought I read it. But anyhow, the next thing you do is you break down into courses: appetizers,
yes,
gumbo, soups and bisques, salads, mains. And then you also do desserts and dessert sauces, which I thought was an odd thing to include in a seafood book. But I checked, and there were no fishy desserts.
Well, you know, we talked about that. We said, now, you know, should we put desserts in? Should we not put desserts in? And we went back and forth, and we said, you know, when you come to New Orleans, you have some great desserts. And we went ahead and put them in.
And they're the classics.
We try to put some of the classics and some of the versions of the classics that we do in our restaurants. And the other thing we added is that there is a section on drinks and spirits.
Yes, I just finished an article on cocktails, so I was interested in seeing that, because you gave birth to many of the established cocktails. And you also have the Museum of the American Cocktail returned to New Orleans yet?
The museum?
Yeah, there's a museum.
Well, there's a museum down. Are you talking about the one on Charter Street?
I don't know.
Down by
the
Royal Orleans. I believe that's reopened.
Okay, it was opened, and then after Katrina, they moved it to Los Angeles, and then they were going to be moving it back. So it's back.
You know, I'm not sure. I'll have to go check. It's two blocks from my office, so I'll walk down there later this afternoon and see.
There you go.
And then you have a section on accompaniments, side dishes, sauces, butters, and dressings is separate. And then seasonings, flours, and breadcrumbs. I've never seen that in a cookbook before, section on that.
We use a number of seasonings that are kind of standard in our restaurants, like our Creole seasoning. And then we use different flours when we on different dishes, and they are seasoned. So we wanted to put those in there because they're used in a number of different recipes.
Yeah. So the book was supposed to be complete. Now I'm going to ask you to do the absolutely impossible, and that is to name the two dishes in the book that are your favorites.
Okay.
You can have three if you like.
That's tough. Well, the first dish I'm going to name is the redfish on the half shell.
Oh, yeah. Why is that on a half shell? I saw that.
Because we leave the skin on.
Ah,
you take it off
see.
The bone,
okay.
You leave the skin on, and you put it on a grill, and you cook it with the skin down. First time I had that dish was when I was out fishing. We came in from fishing, and one of the guides that we were with took the fish, boned it, and left the skin on and threw it on the grill. And I still remember that dish to this day, eating it on that boat.
Oh,
and it was
yeah.
the most wonderful flavor. And it's very simple and just a little bit of seasoning, and yet the freshest that the fish can be.
Okay, that's one. Okay.
That's one.
Okay, now
one,
number two.
This is the one I only eat with friends because it's so rich. That's barbecue shrimp.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Our version is a little bit different because many of the versions in New Orleans, they bake the shrimp, and as a result, the sauce breaks down and the butter breaks down and it becomes very oily and greasy. And what we do is we saute the shrimp first, and then we emulsify some butter in and make a very rich, creamy sauce. And with all the black pepper that's in there and the Creole seasoning, what I love to do is eat the shrimp and then get a piece of hot French bread
right.
and dip it in the sauce.
it's
a cardiac killer.
you could just do it with a spoon.
You could do it with a spoon, but it's much better with French bread or any bread. And I love it, but I will only eat it with friends now. And I eat one or two shrimp and then a couple of pieces of bread and sauce.
That's it.
But it's a wonderful dish, and it's probably one of the most representative dishes of New Orleans, especially in the shrimp category.
Well, listen, let's just before we conclude, give us a report on New Orleans today. New Orleans today is well back from Katrina?
Well, parts of it are. It's sort of a tale of two cities. The French Quarter, the downtown business district, anything along the river up all the way to Tulane University is in very good shape. Because it was on high ground and had limited flooding, if any flooding. The parts of the city that flooded, the center parts of the city, New Orleans East, et cetera, especially in areas where the flood water sat for 2 or 3 months, they're struggling to come back. You find pockets where individual homeowners have gone in and worked together as a group, and they built back a whole block, and then you'll see a block or two with very little happening. It's going to take a long time for us to get back to where we were.
But you think you'll get back there?
We will get back there. Now, you know, from a visitor standpoint, the city's back.
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
it's
that's
been back.
Great.
You know,
this
because you
true.
Come in, you stay in around the French Quarter. You know, you can take the St. Charles streetcar up, you know, all the way up to Tulane University and Audubon Park, and it looks as normal as can be. Garden District looks great. So it really is a tale of two cities. But we're coming back slowly.
Did you ever get to see Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie?
I have not. There are spottings of them and sightings, I mean, but I haven't seen them.
Now they should be coming to your restaurant, right?
No, spottings of Ralph Brennan are much more important than spottings. It's funny, Brangelina, or whatever they call them.
Pitt has that great housing program. Is that working?
It appears to be. It's in the early stages.
Okay.
There's a lot of effort going on. That's an area called the Lower Ninth Ward,
and
working hard to bring that back. He and other groups are working hard to bring some of the housing back in that area. That's an area that was really devastating.
But, you know, you just wonder sometimes about destiny. I mean, there's always going to be another storm, isn't there?
There will be another one. Hopefully we have provided for the next storm.
You think it's fixed up? Enough.
Well, listen, we're going to get mournful soon.
talking about disasters, and we should be thinking about, we should be contemplating these glorious recipes in this wonderful book.
Yeah, I'm looking baked oysters, Ralph. I've been turning that page over and over again.
The book falls open at that page.
Yeah,
Ralph, we thank you so much for joining us. We know you had to rush lunch to get with us on the program, and I'm sure you have dinner ahead of you. So let us let you go. Once again, the name of the book is, sweetheart?
Yes, New Orleans Seafood Cookbook,
by Ralph Brennan.
Definitive take on the subject with the extra benefit of non-fishy desserts.
By Ralph Brennan, not to be confused with his
and
cousin
food.
Dickie.
Right, exactly.
so you can live the whole New Orleans life through this book. And Ralph, it's been a delight to talk to you today.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ralph. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, we ran over time again.
But it was so much fun.
And we hope you enjoyed this week's program, and we'll look for you same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.